How you feeling?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's recording. Just okay. So you know, I'm the only one that can see the monitor.
I'll just go off your cues.
Yeah. You should be feeling really good. You walk tomorrow for graduation.
Which I'm really nervous about, and I don't know why, because I've walked in a straight line before many times in my life, and I've engaged with people while walking in a straight line, and yet I'm nervous about it for some unknown reason.
Yeah, I think everyone feels that way. Do you remember doing it for undergrad?
Yeah, so, like, when we got there, and this is the worst part, and I like this about Wayne compared to, and maybe it's just they make their undergrad sit in alphabetical order, but tomorrow I can sit by Laura, and so that'll be fine.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, so you can sit wherever you want, and, like, they just read your card beforehand.
Yeah.
I was really nervous, and then, like, they had a camera up there, and people were making faces, like, at the camera as I walked, and I was like, that's too much stress. I'm focused on walking across the stage.
Yeah.
And not falling, because I'm very clumsy, and I was like, I don't need the added stress of the camera, and then we get done with the ceremony, and my dad's like, you didn't wave at the camera, and I'm like, Dad, yeah. I was focused on walking across the stage.
Yeah, my undergrad, we could sit wherever we wanted. We were, like, semi-alphabetical, but I don't think we ended up staying that, because we did have the cards to give them to read our names. And I sat next to a friend of mine who I actually really want to interview for this podcast, because she owns a craft beer export business, and I interviewed her for my old podcast, and she's great. But, so she was, like, next to me, and she had little bottles of, like, from, like, little bars in hotel rooms of, like, vodka or whatever. And I was not that kind of person in college or ever in my life. But I just was feeling it that day at graduation. And she's like, do you want to do a shot with me? And I was like, yes. And so I did it with her. And I feel so, I still feel like she's very cool. And she's the nicest person. But I always thought she was just, like, super cool to be friends with me. And so I was like, oh my God, I got a shot from Shannon. And then we walked across the stage. It felt very cool. So that was my undergrad experience.
See, mine, I feel like it was so long ago, even though it wasn't. And, like, all I remember is being really bored with the speaker.
Oh, yeah, our speaker wasn't great either.
And then we finally get across the stage, and I'm waiting for my best friend, who, like, we went to college together. And I'm a P, and she's a V. And so, like, we're standing there, like, waiting. And then my ex-boyfriend... Like, and that was, like, the last time I saw him, and we dated, like, basically the whole time I was in college. And so, honestly, seeing him and, like, having that awkward interaction sticks in my mind more than the whole ceremony is.
Our speaker was so bad, and then our student speaker was really good. I don't really remember what she said, but I remember feeling like she was a really good speaker and enjoying her speech. And then we had some guy who was... I don't know what he did, something in politics, because my college was all about people wanted to go into politics and international relations and stuff, and I don't even know if he said anything I disagreed with. I just was so boring and bad. I just didn't care. And I just wanted to graduate.
Yeah, I think we were just talking about this yesterday, but at my alma mater last year, they had Rick Snyder, and a lot of people turned their backs or, like, protested. And then this year, they have Debbie Stabenow. And I'm like, and my brother's graduating next year. And I'm like, Bob, why couldn't you be graduating
this year?
I would love to listen to Debbie Stabenow. And now I'm like, you're going to get someone crappy like I had when I graduated. I know it. I just know it.
I did go, so our college had a graduation, and then they had, like, the university graduation, and I did attend that. You didn't have to, but I did attend that, and that had, who did we have for ours? The year after me, it was, like, Michael Moore, and I was like, God damn it, I couldn't have had Michael Moore. I don't remember who I had for that, but the big convocation ceremony, and I ended up getting my picture on, like, the big screen and stuff. That was kind of fun.
I'm really hoping it'll be Tom Izzo, because Tom Izzo went to Northern.
Yeah.
And I'm like, please.
That would be a good one.
Yes, yeah. I would love to.
Yeah, he'd be great.
But I don't know. We'll see.
Do you know who your speaker is tomorrow?
I don't know if there's an official speaker. I think that there's individuals, because it's like four or five schools.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of people graduate robes today on campus.
Yeah, so they're like doing them like, I don't know if there's one or two today, and then there's two tomorrow. Jack White is getting his honorary doctorate tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
And I was like, thank God, it's not slowing down my ceremony. Which isn't the right mindset, but, you know, these things can be a little...
It's your day. It's your day to celebrate.
Yeah, and I just want to get through the ceremony and then go hang out at Punch Bowl Social and play some games.
Nice.
But I don't think that they have an official one. I know Paula is speaking for the School of Information Science, but I don't know about anybody else.
Yeah. So. It's fine. It's your day, whatever. We have a lot of people graduating from the history department. I put up a post. It was really funny. On Facebook, listing all the names.
And you forgot Sierra.
And then, well, I had specifically done it to include her, because, like, I had been waiting for the department to post her picture and stuff, and it came, like, really late, and then I was going to post all the names, and then they posted a bunch of tweets about other people I didn't know had graduated, or I didn't know at all, and so I was, like, making sure to pull those names, and then the name I forget was my best friend. Like, what is wrong with me? So I texted her after. I was like, and then, because then Dr. Hart put on Sierra, and then someone else added Josh Morris, who's a PhD, and which is fine. Like, I can't know everything, but of all the people to forget.
That's how it goes, is, you know, we were doing an induction to the National Honor Society when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And the person I forgot was the friend that I've had since I was, like, 3 years old, and, like, I read everybody else's name, and I forgot her name, and I was like, guess that's how it goes. The person you shouldn't forget is...
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, they have to forgive you. You know, they're your friend. Like,
they're
someone
legally
else can,
obligated.
Yeah, someone else can feel, like, really angry and upset, but they have to be like, oh, that's kind of funny, of all the people you'd forget. Like, I'm it's Sierra's birthday also tomorrow. I'm going out with her to celebrate her graduation. Like, just terrible. You're and right. I read her master's essay. Like, God, I feel bad.
You know what, though? She has to forgive you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But she'll also tease you about it for the rest of your life.
I texted her. I don't even think she even saw the Facebook post, probably. But I had to text her about it and be like, so this happened.
Well, I'm sure that at a certain point, because Dr. Hart's comment is still on there, she'll realize you forgot her.
And so I texted her about it, and she's like, well, I was like, you have to forgive me. I'm so sorry. She's like, we'll see.
Well, we were commenting on that because we were like, she and I like defended our on like the same day.
Yeah.
And we were like waiting because like we both had to like take pictures.
Yeah.
And then mine got posted first. And I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, I was, because I knew when she did hers and I was just like,
what is going on?
Did she
on?
Not want a picture taken? Like, because I saw Laura's and I saw yours and Kristen's.
Funny.
And then, yeah, there were two guys, Zachary, who I had a class with, and someone else who I didn't know their name at all. Which is fine. You know, it's a big department. I don't know everyone.
That's true.
Oh, my God. I'm ready. I'm ready for summer, although we're both going to be very busy. You got a job. You don't have to say where you work. That's okay. You can keep that private. But congratulations on your job.
Thank you.
And you got into the PhD program at Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
We both got scholarships for next year.
We did.
Very happy about that.
We're overachievers.
Yes. Yeah. And then I'm very excited. I'm going to announce it just because I'm so proud of myself. So our karate organization that we are a part of has an annual award ceremony in Gatlinburg during a tournament. And then they induct people into the Hall of Fame. And then they have these other awards they give out. And I am in the top five. So you get top five and then they announce number one at the ceremony. So I got top five for female karateka adult division. So it just means female karate student. And then, big surprise, I got top five. It's called Spirit of Ishinru Award. It's, like, named after someone. And then, you know, Spirit of Ishinru, which is, like, means you have to, like, I mean, I know I do these things, but you have to, like, be dedicated to the style, and you have to put in a lot of extra hours. And all the people in that field are all men except me. So I was like, snap, because it's a very, very masculine world in martial arts. Like,
you know, I think that says something about you, too, is that you didn't realize that you were doing all these extra things. Because, well, and that's the thing is, like, we were doing, like, my Carhartt internship review. And he's like, you just have this ability to, like, anticipate, like, what I need. And, like, what, like, the next step. And I'm just like, I don't think about it like that.
Right.
I think about doing my job and thinking what's coming next.
Yeah. And you know, and it's like, it means, because it's not like everyone in the nation knows who I am. It just means that people from my dojo nominated me for that award.
They're going to find out.
And I knew that people, you know, we all nominate each other, right? So I got five of the people that I nominated got into the top five. I was very excited about that. Partially because I'm an adult and know how to write nominations. A lot of kids are writing nominations, right? So they don't know what they're doing. But, Yeah, so I was very, you know, super excited for my kids that got nominated, and there was another adult I nominated for something. And then I saw my name twice, although my name is spelled wrong on the little list they sent out. But, yeah, I spelled my name properly with an E-L, not A-E-L, for Rachel. But, yeah, I was just like, I didn't know people were nominating me for that award. That's like, I mean, I think most people who win that award, I don't know if I'll win, probably not because of a lot of reasons, but are like older, like much older than me. Like they've been in this world for a long time.
So do you know like the people who nominated you then? Are they like...
Some of them. So like to get our students to do the nominations, because it's like pulling teeth because they're all kids and teenagers and you're like, you need to do this. And they don't understand the importance of it because it really helps our school and all that kind of stuff. I set up like a form that they could take, and like, so if I want to nominate you, I'd be like, hi Allie, I want to nominate you, and it has everything that you need to know to write a nomination. So you need to know their name, address, phone number, age, rank, belt rank, and then you know, who the senseis are, who our teachers are, and then who our dojo's address. And then I have like three or four questions you can go through. So like, what's your favorite part of karate? Why do you like karate? How long have you been doing karate? What do you do for the dojo? Like, you know, volunteering, we march in parades and stuff. And then you ask them like, oh, what do you do outside of karate? So do you volunteer? Do you like work in your school? Are you a safety for like our little kids in elementary school and all that kind of stuff? Do you work with your church? Anything like that can make a nomination. So I made a whole sheet for them to go, and so that they have to print out the sheet and then they have to fill it out with their little friend that they want to nominate. So I did that. So I guess that might have helped me myself get a
nomination. Probably. But I think though too, like, well, you think you might not get it because a lot of the nominators for the other people might be older. I think that, you know, having a lot of kids nominate you would help you because it shows, you know, you're encouraging all of these young people who are just starting in this sport. And that often is the make or break. I mean, I played soccer for a large chunk of my life.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the good coaches. I remember the guy who got me to quit. And,
oh, no.
But that's what I mean is as an adult in a sport, you have the capacity to positively or negatively influence someone's experience. And I think that having lots of little kids write reviews for you could help you win this award.
They're
so
cute.
You're selling yourself a little short.
Aww,
there.
Thanks. Oh, do you want to know one more exciting thing about my life?
Of course.
Well, a lot of our students are Indian in our dojo, and one of them, they're celebrating at their temple. I don't know what it's called, but it's something about gurus, so teachers. And he invited our other sensei first, but they're out of town, so he invited me to come to the ceremony with him on Sunday, and it's about honoring teachers in your life. And so I'm really excited. I get to go to their temple with them, and they, you know, present, all the little kids present whatever teachers they brought with them, little like flowers and little gifts, and then we get to have a tour of the temple and stuff, and I feel really excited about that.
I mean, that'll be really amazing.
Yeah, it'll be really cool. I asked the mom, I was like, because a lot of colors mean things in different cultures, so I said, I asked her if there was any colors I should or shouldn't wear. And she said no. She said, "What, you know, whatever you want to wear."
And whatever you wear is...
Yeah, wrong, right? But she did say, she said, bring a scarf just in case you have a tour of the temple and then you have to, like, wear a scarf.
Oh.
I said, oh, I can handle that.
Yeah.
I can do that. So that's fun.
Seems not complicated.
Mm-hmm. So, you're going to start your PhD in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking forward to it or are you nervous?
I wouldn't say that I'm nervous for it. I think that there's been a lot of flipping. I don't think that that's the right way to say it. So I've been coming up with ideas about stuff I want to write on because I'm really passionate about a lot of topics.
Yeah.
And they don't really necessarily go together.
Right.
It's
I feel
you.
It's
sort of like, you know, and so like, I'll be like, oh, I'd love to write about this. And Liz will be like, well, this has kind of been done a lot, and so then we're in my defense, and she suggested another topic, and after she left, Portia was like, oh, well, you know, you don't have to write about that, and I'm like, I love Liz because she gives me a suggestion every time.
I would like that.
I see her. Yeah, oh yeah, because it's like, well, I'd like to do this, and she's like, well, you know, that's kind of been done, so why don't you tweak it like this, but then, and I love her because it always ends with, but at the end of the day, you do what you want to do, and I'll be behind you.
Yeah,
and so, but I love it because you know, really to stay on the edge in this profession is you have to be unique. You have to do something that's relatively unique. And I like that about her because it's, you know, she's like, you know, this has been done, but here's how you can make it so it's not done.
Yeah.
And so I'm both excited and not excited.
Well, you've got some time too, even though you can. So I've known PhDs that have gone both ways. Some have, any classes they took, they kind of tried to work their papers so it could be a chapter or part of a chapter for that class for their dissertation. And then others have just taken classes because they needed to take classes and they wrote on things they found interesting. Maybe they could turn it into an article, something like that. And then they, once they finished their coursework, they started doing their research and working on their dissertation.
Yeah. So. And I don't like, I would rather, I don't like to think about like what I want to write on. Like, I'm definitely in the second camp where it's like, I want to get, you know, immersed in that class.
Yeah.
And I want to think about that class. And then I'll decide what I want to write on. And I like to keep those two things separate.
So, since you did your MA and then you're doing your PhD at the same place, mm-hmm. how much coursework do you have to go through? Do you have to just do one more year? I know you have to get your cognates from another other departments or whatever.
So that's sort of problematic to a certain extent is there's been some, even just some switching within the graduate school in the last couple of years, because it used to be that you could transfer 35 credits.
Yeah.
And then the graduate school says, no, you can't do more than 30. Okay. And then the history department has officially said 32 because that's more obtainable, just the way that they structure courses.
Right, what you need,
Yeah, so I can bring in 32, and so that's sort of, it's about deciding what I want to bring in with me.
Yeah.
Because I can bring in...
Can you bring in methods, or do you have to take that again?
No, I don't have to take that.
Oh, good. I know.
No, I don't have to take it again because, and that's the thing is I think that you didn't, I was told you had to take it, so I did take it. And I think now the people who are doing the dual degree are sort of, they're moving away from just having an MA and it's becoming you do the dual, but and you get an MA PH.
Oh,
which I think isn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea. And I think,
well, I think it depends on what the student wants. I think more are going for MPH, MA PH
with
library science.
I don't know. And
science.
So that would be something we'd have to check in because I heard that they were sort of being pushed in that direction. Just because
I believe that.
Because of the way it structures out is you don't really have enough history credit. So unless you do stay at Wayne State.
Like I did for 4 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like me. And so so many of my credits will transfer, 32 will transfer in and I can bring all my CIS or INF cognates with me.
Oh, okay.
But I probably will bring in less just because of the whole scheduling thing.
Yeah.
And the political science department, you can take a lot of their classes for the public history part, and they're offered in the nighttime, which I think is very good of the political science department because it shows they're aware of...
Yeah, what their students are doing. I was just curious because, you know, it's not like you change institutions. I could see someone coming from outside and them, you know, saying you can take X amount, but you still have to take the methods or you still have to take this one class. But yeah, so for cognates, do you think, I mean, you don't have to know the answer to this. I always push people and be like, and then someone asks me and I'm like, I don't know. So besides poli-sci, are there any other departments like anthro or GSW or?
You know, I think it's going to be because I'm very interested in, the reason I want to get my PhD is because I'd love to run a museum or be involved in some sort of cultural heritage institution like that.
Yeah.
And I think that the political science classes that I'm interested in are about running nonprofits, and I think that that's a really valuable experience.
Anthro might be a good place
I don't feel like, and that's the thing, is I spent a year and a half working in a museum, and I feel like I have a really good grasp on, I mean, besides seeing, you know, the financials of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like I've got a really good grasp on that, and so I think that I would be bored to tears in a museum studies class.
Right.
Just because I did it, and I think that if you've never, you know, worked in a museum, and that's what I'm very fortunate to have worked in a museum where it was a small staff, and so I did get to do a lot of stuff, so that I feel really confident in my ability to do programming or to do exhibit or to, you know, negotiate funds and or any of that stuff. I feel really fortunate that I can say I'm willing to do that, but
I took the public history methods class just because it sounded interesting, and I technically all I needed was like some cognates and the memory class, and I could have done the MAPH, but I met some anthro grad students in that class, and they were really nice, and it sounded like their classes were really interesting.
I think, you know, and that's the thing, too, is a lot of mine is going to come down to scheduling.
Yeah.
And so, and I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
But I've heard equal complaints about different classes that yeah. you can take with the MAPH, and I think that it's a really great program, and I think that they'll figure it out. But I'm
yeah.
excited to dig into...
Will that be one of your... So you have to have, like, what, two major areas and then a minor? So,
so
can PH, can public history be a major or is it a minor?
It has to be a minor.
But
so,
you'll do that?
Yeah. So yeah. I'm doing North America, well, U.S. history.
Yeah.
I guess technically since 1877,
uh-huh.
but I don't think that they're going to watch that really closely.
Yeah.
Because I'm interested in all of U.S. history.
Yeah.
But, and then labor.
Okay.
Obviously. and then my minor will be public history.
Nice. I like, I think that sounds good.
Yeah.
Especially, for what you want to do and the type of places you want to work. Those
yeah.
all go really well together.
And a lot of my research has been, like, early 20th century. And so, like, the topics we're talking about for my dissertation are, like, the second half of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, there's a lot of things I'm going to have to... I don't care what you guys were doing in the 50s, and the 60s, and the 70s, and the 80s. Give me pre-the Great War. And
yeah.
I'm content there. But all that stuff's been written about, and so, you know, I'm really excited to, you know, learn about it. But then I'm also, you know, it's about finding something that I'm really passionate about. And so one of the things I've thought about doing is, have you read A Midwife's Tale? Or, like, seen the way it's structured?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, when we were talking about topics, Liz was saying, you have to find a top, like, find a book, even if that's where you start. Find a book that you like the way it's structured. And
uh-huh.
go from there. And so I spent 2 summers transcribing a lighthouse log.
Yeah.
And my master's, you know, essay was on the daughter of the lighthouse keeper using the log as, like, the starting point.
Yeah.
And so I think that that, you know, if I could figure out the best way that to sort of structure it, because
uh-huh.
I don't think that chronological would be the right way to approach it at a
right.
certain extent. I think that topically would be better.
Yeah.
But then, and so then it would be finding a way to structure the lighthouse log within a midwife's tale structure
uh-huh.
and then flushing that out, I think would be something that I would be.
I mean, your experience in archives and stuff really sets you up better, I think, than other people, because you really know how to, like, find something and then, and just being comfortable with the archives and staying in there and finding something unique, because that's unique. No one's writing about that lighthouse log, right? You
right.
are. So that's you're in there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if I could give any advice to any, like, any history PhDs, is it's like, you know, find an archivist. Archivists love to talk to you about the archives. Archivists love to have coffee with you.
Yeah.
Have, you know, spend an hour talking to an archivist, because that's going to be the fastest way that you find your collection and discover.
Right.
Because they know what's in your... I mean, at my job right now, I'm processing this collection from business executives. And so I was like, I feel like maybe I'm over-describing this. And my boss said it the best way possible. She said, no one is going to ever look at this collection the way that you're looking at this collection right now.
Right.
And so if you think that it's important, you need to note it, because we're never going to find it again unless,
right.
unless you note it. And so, you know, I found a labor document about negotiations with Walter Reuther. And
mm-hmm.
I was like, better write this down, because
yeah.
no, I mean, otherwise they won't find it again. And
right.
so I think that the best advice is, you know, is don't be scared of the archive. Get in there.
Yeah.
And make friends with the archivist, because they're all nice people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm getting that archival certificate, but definitely still afraid of the archives.
Just gotta get your hands dirty.
Yeah. I'm a very, macro person, and I didn't really realize that until recently in life.
Yeah.
Like, I used to think I was like a micro in there, but I'm much more macro oriented
yeah.
to that kind of work, and like I love them and I support them and the humanities and want to do things for them, but I'm not like a citizen's archivist or like a Like, I like that stuff to a certain extent, but I'm not as into it as some other people that are getting the certificate.
Yeah.
And we've talked about that. Like, you just need all different types of people that understand all the levels of stuff. Like, my research paper for description and access, I did a case study, and everyone really liked it. I did really well on the paper. I was surprised. Was on social media of a couple Michigan archives, and just specifically looking at their Instagrams, and if they were... using their Instagram enough to get people in the door to the archive. And the conclusion was not really.
Right.
Like some of them. So basically what I did was I set up a case study where I would just look at their Instagrams and the pictures they showed, not ones like promoting events, but like historic photos. And if I could use the information they provided on Instagram, either within the photo or like in their description, to find it on their website or to find at least the collection it came from. And some archives and organizations were better at that than others. And it's not, I mean, I understand, you know, researchers aren't necessarily going to Instagram for research, but they might be. They might be at a,
yeah.
They might be in California, you know, not able to get money to come here or trying to figure out if it's worth coming. And they've hit a brick wall of yeah. like whatever they're looking at. And they're just like on Instagram because they're curious as to what this place has. Who knows? You know, we just don't know where this technology and connection of people is taking us. And so it was a really fun and interesting way to, like, think about archives and how they can use Web 2.0 technology.
I think the best way I've heard it is she used to be the library assistant for the Georgia State Special Collections, like their university archives. She's not there anymore. She got promoted, of course, because she's very talented. But the way she described it to me with their social media and the way they approached it is you have to pick an audience.
Yeah.
And who's your audience going to be?
Yeah.
And hers was students.
Yeah,
and you
yeah.
You can see that that's reflected in the way that they did their...
Mm-hmm.
Their specifically their Instagram, because she would post an image from a collection and then she'd give you a little blurb.
Yeah.
And so if you're working on a class that's, you know, related to women's history or
right.
labor history or Georgia history, here's this image and here's this little blurb. And then at the end, she always says, DM us if you would like more information.
That's great. None of the archives I looked at were that good at it.
Well, I think it was solely her, because before Jennifer,
yeah.
which is her name, came in, I don't think that they had a social media presence that
right.
was that strong. And so, you know, the library system itself, and they got someone from marketing to say, you know, you have to pick a target audience.
Right.
And they decided to go with students.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, like you just said, the dedicated researcher who knows that you have the collection they want is coming through your door
regardless
of what you put on any social media
right.
platform anywhere. But the one who didn't know, like you said, as a student yourself,
yeah, yeah.
who's not very comfortable with the archive, if an archive posted a picture that you saw
yeah.
and you knew that was related to your research topic, you're going through the door now because you know exactly what's there. You've DM'd someone, so
right.
you have the answers.
Or sometimes they'll include links
mm-hmm.
right to, like,
the finding aid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I read a fascinating article about finding aids and how they were getting people to access their online finding aids, and that was really interesting. So, yeah, I find that macro-level organizational stuff
yeah, and
for
I mean,
these institutions more interesting than the
yeah.
on the ground.
And I know people at the Reuther have, you know, they've linked finding aids or like the description of the collection with the finding aid
mm-hmm.
in it to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
So if you're reading a Wikipedia page,
yeah.
you can then go down to the bottom to the see additional sources, and then you click that link and it'll kick you to the finding aid. And
yeah.
I think that's
great.
A great use
yeah.
of it. And,
oh, for sure.
But I also know from, you know, the internal side, sometimes it's hard to get really sexy stuff from your archivist to
right.
put on. If you're
yeah.
just the social media person and you don't know that much about
yeah.
the collections, you're relying on these.
Oh, yeah. It's a hard job, and you have to be super proactive. And it's hard because you end up running social media accounts for other organizations and stuff. You take it home because you put it on your phone because that's the easiest way for you
mm-hmm.
to access it. And it's hard to, like, not be doing it. So, and then you have to go after stuff, and you have to, it's like pulling teeth again to get people to give you stuff. Because they don't see it that way. They just think, well, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. But now with what they call Web 2.0, and then other articles have called it, like, Archives 2.0 and things
yeah.
like that, you have to do more. And who knows where we're going in, you know, 10
years. Well, I think that's the thing is, you know, archivists are more, and there are still some old school, but, you know, newer archivists like myself are really how can we engage in the digital sphere? And that's something that is going to be a problem for me working in a corporate archive, because they're less concerned with, because there's their clear person who we're serving. And so there's, you know, a less interaction with the public, but a public archive should be looking at how can we get people in, and especially students, if you're a university archive.
Yeah.
And Instagram is the best way, you know.
Oh, yeah, especially with, photos.
Share your buttons,
like
share
that.
Your events, but also share your historic photos and tell us about your collection.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I love following different ones. And, you know, NARA has guidelines about social media, and they have, you know, I mean, I saw it more like a year ago. I don't know if it's petered out, but they would have hashtags like dance, you know, dancing days, and, you know, show us a picture from your archive of people dancing or like whatever it is. So, yeah, that stuff it'll be interesting to see where it goes, because, you know, online, on Twitter especially, there's tons of academics that use Twitter, and they reach out to other academics if they're trying to find something and work on things, and there's no reason that institutions shouldn't also be a part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I like that kind of stuff.
I think that lots of archives are, you know, trying to get in that discussion, but at a certain point, you know, unless a historian who's being asked about the research they did quickly says, contact so-and-so at the such-and-such.
Oh, yeah, sure. And it's just hard to, you know, I think it's taken a couple years to take that stuff seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter and Instagram and even Facebook and other things.
Like a history professor I was talking to, and I don't feel like this is something that they should, like, that people should brag about, but one of them, he was saying that another professor was like, oh, well, I don't check my emails. Like,
oh, yeah.
And I don't think that that's the right attitude, because it's, and I find this especially, like, in history, is there's a great pushback against technology, and it's like, you better get along or you're going to be left behind.
Right,
because these new job descriptions, especially in public history or universities, they want to see, can you interact with our changing demographics in the university? And they're online. They're interacting at home. And that's something that, you know, get ready because it's coming slowly.
Are you
going to
take that HISTCOM class?
I don't know when it is.
Yeah, I don't either. I have no idea. And remember, they had it last year, and it sounded great. I just wasn't able to take it.
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to look at it. Is it in the communications department?
Mm-mm. It's a history class.
Oh, I'll look it up later.
So I tried to get people to send us questions on Twitter.
Send us your questions.
But no one did except Tracy. She's great.
She wants to know about our lives.
She does. So this is the question that she asked us. I'll double check if anyone sent one in today, because I did send out another request. But she said, you're both dual degree students. What do you wish students in single degree programs and faculty members in history and in SIS knew about the unique challenges facing students in dual degree programs? I'll let you go first.
Okay. I think that this question is sort of perfect for the two of us, as we both did it, but we did it in opposite directions.
Yeah.
So I really became heavily involved in the School of Information Science. I was president for 3 years of one of the organizations. I was, an officer in another organization within the department for 2 years. And so I think we both did it.
Yeah.
But to me, it's about being accessible. And I think that this is something that I always tried to emphasize within my camp of the School of Information Science, is it's about interacting with the other school and getting them to realize it. And so I think that I got a lot of pushback sometimes from history professors about what classes I was taking, or like taking more classes or not being able to take their class because I had to take a CIS class.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like that pushback was necessarily fair sometimes, because it's, you know, I'm doing 2 degrees.
Yeah.
And I would love to take every class because I'm a history nerd, and that's why I'm doing a master's degree in the first place.
Right.
But it's, you know, there are certain check boxes that we have to check, and I can't take, you know, all the classes I'd love to take because I have to check these boxes. I mean, there are classes that I wish I hadn't had to take, but I did have to take them, and Would that I could go back and change this. But I think that it's a fair question, and especially, like, I know that I faced this, and I'm sure other people feel this way in the reversal in the history department, which Ray will talk about, is it's just I felt at a certain point that the history department was inaccessible to me, just the way that certain events were scheduled, because I was working, and when I wasn't working, I was in classes, and some of the events being in the middle of the day, it felt really inaccessible to me. And so what appealed to me about CIS was that you could attend from your couch, or you could attend, you know, in the evenings when you had free time. And so I think that that's something that I wish the history department, who I know isn't responsible for scheduling every event that happens on campus, but just, you know, some of us are working, and when we're not working, we're in class. And so, you know, maybe greater access to things in the evening is what I would request.
And online technology.
And online. And, yeah. You know, and that's the thing is I'm sure the UGL has it, and I know that, you know, the Pretty Kresge Library where the CIS offices are, and maybe, you know, there can be some collaboration there since it is a collaborative degree.
Right.
About sharing those spaces.
Yeah.
To make things recorded or to make them available in the evening.
Yeah. I would say, I came to Wayne specifically to do both, but somehow I got told the opposite of what most people get told, because I hear most people get told apply to library science and then apply to history, because you don't need the GRE for library science. But somehow someone was like, you should apply to history first and then library science. I don't know why. I can tell you who told me that later. but so I did that, and I got into the history department, and then I just waited until... So I started library science a semester after, which was fine. It's still... pretty much ran tangentially together. But the thing was I just wasn't fully... And then I added archives, so I get that I added something I didn't necessarily need. If you just want to do the two master's
I did it all.
Programs, yeah. But it took you 3 years, right?
It honestly took me 3 years because of lack of funding and because I went to Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. So it took me 4 years, and I had funding... every year, thank you very much. But it just, granted, my first semester, I wasn't quite sure which, like, history field to go into. So I did take two, like, semi-exploratory classes, which I think is important. I don't think people should be punished for that. But it's going to take me 4 years. And I did take SIS classes online two of those summers that I was in school. So I think that people need to know that it's not going to be 2 years. Regardless, like even people I know who did history with the archives and not even adding LIS,
yeah.
It still takes you more time than maybe they're upfront about.
Yeah, and that's something that I'd like to add too is it's, I get that people don't want to teach in the summer. I get it's not sexy to teach in the summer. But I
and they're doing research. A lot of, if you're in the history, a lot of them use that time.
Yeah, which I think is great. Research. But then my advice to me with that is if that's not going to change where history classes are being offered in the summer, then plan your courses out wisely and plan to take your summer, your CIS required courses in the summertime.
Yeah.
Because those are consistently offered every summer.
Yeah.
And so take your electives and your history courses in the fall and the winter and then hit up your requireds in the summer.
Yeah, I did one summer I did one class and the other summer I did two.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of work to do in the summer because you have to kind of make yourself... be on the computer
faster.
And do it, and it moves faster. But I was happy to have gotten those out of the way while I was not in my other classes. But yeah, so I think people need to know that it's going to take you longer, and if you're someone that isn't getting funding for whatever reason, or you're working, and I also worked, I mean, I worked part-time at a fairly loose job that let me make my own hours, very lucky for me, but... you just need to know that it's not going to happen within a year or two, like some other master's programs. Like, I just think that it wasn't clear to me when I first was looking at the programs online and at the university.
And that number is if you take a full course load.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with taking a full course load because...
And there's nothing wrong with not.
Right. Neither is wrong. What I would more heavily emphasize is internships because we just had my practicum meeting.
Yeah, we're very opposite that way.
We just had a practicum meeting and I felt, and this is probably me because I have done a lot of internships and I have volunteered and I have gone to do, and that's probably why coming out, I already have a job.
Yeah.
Is to be completely honest. But, you know, we had this practicum meeting, and a lot of people who... The practicum is one of the last classes you take. And they're saying, this is, like, the first time I was in an archive.
Right.
Or, like, that I was doing archival work.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
That... What?
Yeah.
You want... You're about to graduate with this degree, and this is the first... And so, you know, both at that critical level that's saying, what can we do in the CIS program to make it so you're in the archives and doing archival work sooner? But also in the same token of, you know, with Wayne State right here and the University of Michigan 45 minutes away, you have to think, what can I do to make myself the most competitive person entering this field?
Yeah.
What about me sticks out? And right. what it's going to be is, did you do extra internships? Did you volunteer? Did you serve on your city's historical commission? Did you serve as a president or a member of any student organization?
Yeah.
Did you do any of those things? Because that's what it's going to zero in on. I mean, for the job that I just got, the person who was my supervisor, just volunteering, not paid or anything, just as like a volunteer intern, was one of my references.
Yeah.
And so she highlighted that in my reference. And she was like, you know, Allie didn't have to come here and do this work, but she did.
Right. And I think that... So, like you said, you went closer to CIS and I went closer to mm-hmm. history. I think partially because I started in history first, so those mm-hmm. were the people I got to know. Plus, it's on campus, so, like, they were physical people. Until later, I started meeting other library science people, but they were the, physical people I saw. And then I was asked to join the HGSA, History Graduate Students Association. And so being in that group and having a leadership role in that group pushed me to think about that department more than LIS. And the when I came in a little before you, it wasn't, when I first applied or first looked, it wasn't 100% online.
No.
And so I had hoped for, like, I live in Metro Detroit, I'm going to be on campus for history, there will be on campus classes. Maybe not every class.
Yeah.
But if you hear that, and then they switched over, like, right when I started.
To be frank,
and there were no online classes.
Well, yeah.
Very few.
And that's part of the reason, and I mean, Laura and I talk about this, is Laura moved here from Grand Rapids because they said you had to be here to do the archival.
Right.
I moved down from the Upper Peninsula where I could have stayed
mm-hmm.
because you had to be.
And then, yeah, then they switched the archives, too, now, which came a little bit later than switching all the LIS classes.
Right, and that's the thing, is when I started, archival administration was in person, and so all of the people, and we were a tight-knit group, and we're all still, we all still know each other because we
Yeah, I mean, I took my class in the Reuther for my
Me too.
Archives class, my first
archives
class.
Yeah, and those people who I took that class with are still the people who I know and who
Same.
I interact with, and...
Yeah.
And so I think that I agree with you there that I think that, you know, having them online has created a sort of student body where you don't know each other.
Right.
And yeah, the counterpoint to that, I will say, is I've taken a lot of history classes in person, and I still don't know that many people in the history department.
I think that's you choosing. No, I'm just teasing.
Maybe.
Not to interact with anyone.
Maybe. But I also think that it's reflective of, you know, I mean, and it's not for a lack of desire, because I'm obviously not afraid to join student organizations. It's more that every time there's an HGSA meeting, I'm in class. I think this semester they literally were scheduled at the time that I was in class.
And that's the thing with HGSA. I've served on it for 2 years, and the next year I'm president.
Mm-hmm.
We have to schedule them when all of our board can be there.
Right.
And everyone who's a graduate student in history is automatically a member and welcome to attend any of the meetings or events. And I tried, as VP of social, I tried to have social events once a week. But again, I wanted to make sure I was at least there as a representative of the organization. We did have a core group of people. This semester we were going to Shangri-La, meet up, and have dinner. But, you know, I hear DOSO's changing as far as funding goes. But before, you had to get reimbursed for everything afterwards. And there's just no way we can put on, like, the impetus on someone to pay money for certain things, or so people had to really be available and have a desire to go to those events and have the money to go eat out. And I know some students don't, and then a lot of students are major commuters. Like myself, I commute, but it's only half an hour and it's really not that bad. Other people are commuting from much further away. Mm-hmm. And so we have to reach a balance, but I think looking into technology for our meetings is going to be my number one priority as president.
Yeah, and I think that you know, and I know Katie drives from Ann Arbor, right?
She's further than that. She's out in Auburn Hills, yeah.
And that's the thing is having implementing the technology then also will allow you to implement evening meetings, because then Katie's not driving.
Yeah.
At 5:30 at night to be on campus for a meeting. She's at home on her couch with her headphones in, attending the meeting via Canvas. And that's the thing is Canvas is this great feature, and SIS has really heavily used it, and that would be another wish of mine, is this conferences feature using Blue Button is amazing, because you don't need to be in the same room as anybody. I mean, for tons of my group projects, we all just hosted each other in the conference. We could all talk to each other, and then...
Yeah.
You know, the whole group project was settled in 25 minutes, and that never happens via email.
So. Yeah, we did ours. I did a lot of my group projects on, Google Chat.
Which that is, kind of thing. And that's in conferences. Yeah. And the Blue Button feature is just like that. And so it's great to have something that's attached to the university that allows you to do that.
I think, as far as Tracy's question goes, I think another thing is, it's just not clear to me that these two departments have a lot of communication between one another.
Agreed.
Like... It just, besides students talking to each other, maybe complaining, maybe talking about courses they liked or didn't like or whatever it is, I think there's communication among students, but I don't think there's communication amongst the two departments. And if you're offering this as a selling point, as a dual degree program, whether that's the MAPH or the MA with MLIS or whatever combination.
Or if there's like... Or if there's like even interaction between like... Because I know Tracy's in charge of the MAPH and Kim's in charge. Even if there's communication between the two of them, it's not funneling down.
Yeah.
And so even if they, like, are on the same page as each other, it's not clear in the SIS office and in the paperwork that you find. And it's not clear
in the history department paperwork.
Or even trying to find your MAPH master's cover sheet. Laura was like, I can't find this. And I was like, well, just use mine. And she figured it out. But, that's the thing is, and I agree with you, is it's not clear.
Yeah. Yeah. It just, because I get it. History is a department and SIS is a school. And I understand there's some differences in the way they function and work and who gets assigned assignments. And I'm, I try to be aware of the pressure that all of our professors are under for, especially in history, as far as, they have to serve on committees, and then they're working on publishing, and they have to publish, publish or perish. And I don't think it's quite like that within SIS, but, so I try to be understanding of that, but at the same time, as a student, it's just, you feel like you're being torn in two directions by both departments sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of have to choose, like we did.
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
One completely. To be more involved with than the other. And, as far as the student groups go for SIS, I was, I thought they were great, and there was a part of me that wanted, but once I had already committed to history and certain departmental things, and then as far as, conferences and stuff go, I haven't been to a lot, but I went to history ones. I didn't end up going to Emory Library Science, and I think being in online classes, I just didn't feel like any of the work I did was, worth it. And I'm not as much of an experiential learner as you, so I'm very much a school person and classroom, so I didn't feel like I did those
things. I feel the same way as you as far as the work that I've produced within SIS courses is and that's the thing is I think that there's just different levels of buildup. Like your piece that you wrote about social media would be great something to publish. The problem, and you just don't feel like it because you weren't in the archive. You weren't doing footnotes. You weren't getting tons of feedback from your professor and then flushing it all out. And it's just a difference of department and programs is within the history department is you spend weeks if not months creating this document and then you're like yes, and then your professor, if they're a good professor, gives you a really detailed final draft back to you so that you and says this is what you should cut, this is what you should keep, I think this is publishable, or I think that you should add this, this, and this to make it publishable,
right?
And that's really clear, and within the SIS department is that's less clear because it doesn't, I think on a certain level, it doesn't feel as academic.
Right.
And I'm not sure why.
Well.
And I don't think I can put my finger on it. But it wasn't
it's a lot of case studies, and it's a lot of people that get published in the various journals mm-hmm. or whatever you're reading about library science or archive science or whatever you want to call it. They are working in archives, or they set up, you know, they were, you know, at U of M and they set up this program and then they tested it and all this stuff. So it's like, you feel like if you're not in those spaces doing those types of case studies, then like, what do you have to say?
And I think that that's like,
because most stuff I read for library science is like case studies. Like, and it wasn't, we did this and it worked or it didn't work. Or
yeah. And honestly, your research is a case study because you're assessing. And I think it wasn't until I started presenting at conferences within library information, starting with posters and then going to like full presentations.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I started doing that that I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, people. And I've been asked specifically, I mean, we did presentations at the National Digital Stewardship Alliance, which is the group I was a president of, at their national conferences. And we've gotten asked if we are going to publish our
findings.
Our findings. At both times we've done it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is it's not until you're there that they're like, oh. And then with the Michigan Black History Bibliography Project that I'm the lead on, the project lead on, we got asked as part of the grant we just received to publish, to do something, to share art, because we're a student group leading the charge on this. We're not an academic institution.
Yeah.
And so we got asked to take the lead on that too. And so that's really interesting, because it and that's the thing, is I think until you get rejected, I would say submit. And that's something I haven't been very good at.
Right. But I, and in history, like more traditional,
it's very black and white what you should publish. Right.
And also
history.
You don't get asked necessarily.
You have to work hard to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not that you didn't work hard for in the library science field.
No, I know what you mean though.
But like, yeah, it's, you don't get asked to do that unless you're already established within the field and you're this famous person.
We can't all be me.
But, you know, it's not that kind of.
Yeah,
it's they're similar in a lot of ways for people that are interested in this stuff, but they're very different.
And I think that that's something within the library and information science is to them, and I'm not sure if this is, you know, 100%, but this is my understanding, is presenting on what you've worked on is equal to publishing.
Yeah.
If you're out there at, you know, at the Midwest Archives Conference or the SAA, the Society of American Archivists National Conference, or you're at, you know, NDSA or
ALA,
or Digital Library, or, yeah, if you're at any of those and you're out there presenting, that's equal to publishing, because you're still gaining attention for the institution.
Right.
You're still, people are still being aware of your work.
Yeah.
And that stuff gets published after the fact.
Right.
Whereas AHA, it doesn't get published. I don't know. It might have. Some of the stuff might be online.
Some, and some smaller conferences do publish some stuff afterwards, but not all of them.
Right.
And you can't, to me it feels like you need to be, there are maybe some superstar master students that are getting, going to these like larger conferences like the AHA, but mostly it's either established people in the field or someone with a Fulbright or someone with, you know, or a PhD that's like, you know, at these universities that are really well known that are on these panels and stuff. It's not student groups and it's not small libraries or, you know, smaller groups or people. You know, they're probably either already established or they're a rising star, and that's just a different vibe, I find.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some fun stuff.
Okay.
What have you been binge watching?
I'm trying to finish Scandal.
Oh, okay.
Finally.
I never watched it, but I had a friend who loved it.
Well, I liked Grey's Anatomy up until a certain point.
I hear that's how the shows go.
In an effort to not spoil something.
Don't spoil anything.
Something happened in Grey's Anatomy that I wasn't happy about.
Yeah.
And once I found out that this thing was going to happen, I was turned off from it. And so I was like, I can't watch this anymore.
I hear that's how her shows go. I've never been, like, a fan of any of her shows. Like, I've just never watched them.
The first couple seasons are really amazing.
And then it goes nuts.
And then if you're not completely invested in the characters, you're screwed.
Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah.
Like, there's a plane crash plot in Grey's Anatomy, and I'm like,
yeah,
I'm not there yet. And that's not the spoiler that I'm not going to say anything that happened. I'm just going to tell you there was a plane crash.
Yeah.
But I was like, a plane crash? a plane crash? Really? And that's sort of where it is with Scandal. The good thing about Scandal compared to Grey's Anatomy is there's only 7 seasons.
Oh, yeah. Really not that many compared to a lot of stuff.
Unfortunately. Well, when there's like 13 or 14 or 15 seasons of Grey's Anatomy, 7's not that much.
Yeah, true.
But I really like Tony Goldwyn, who plays the president.
Oh, okay.
He's a dreamboat. So, you know. But that's really keeping me plugging along.
All right. I have all the DVDs of Doctor Who from the 2008 till the 10th Doc? No, through the 11th Doctor seasons plus the 50th. So I started back, and I mean, I've seen them all, but I started back and watched them, and then there's some specials. And so I just got through the 10th Doctor specials, and then now I'm going to start the 11th Doctor's DVDs. Mm. And so I've been enjoying that.
Ooh, I do want to say, going off someone's suggestion, Tracy's suggestion to watch that You show on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
Okay. I didn't watch that
so
one.
So good.
Okay.
And I it, need and to it's add like, that. It's like, and it, I don't know if you like John Stamos, but he's in it.
Oh, okay.
So.
I'm not opposed to John Stamos.
And he's got a beard.
Yeah, oh, it's really okay. Working. All right.
But, and it keeps you guessing. Yeah. Like, literally, we're in the 8th episode, and I'm like, I think I know where this is going. And then something happened, and I'm like,
oh, yeah.
What?
What else was I binge-watching recently? I did watch something on Netflix that was really good. I've been, like, keeping up with Jane the Virgin, Big Bang Theory.
Are you going to watch that?
Game of Thrones.
New documentary that just came out about the women in Congress on Netflix?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much stuff that comes out, and I hear about everything, and I'm like,
ready to watch it. I didn't watch it because I was like, what if Ray's going to want to watch it this afternoon? Can't watch this.
There's a new HBO movie coming out about, so I just went to MSU for a retirement party, and
I went to the museum. Share that exhibit. I'm yeah, really hurt you didn't ask me to go with sorry. You, but now I'm going to ask Sierra to go with
oh,
me,
yeah.
So it all worked out.
I like that the two of you are going to go without me.
You can come with us again if you want to see it again.
The exhibit it's really good. It's, you know, it's small and it's
well,
really
just
powerful.
Going off, you know, what Sierra researches, like,
yeah.
figured, should like to go to this
yeah.
with me.
But yeah, there's a new HBO documentary coming out about, the sister survivors and
yeah.
all, everything they
Have you
through.
Seen the one that Mariska Hargitay made and it's about her foundation?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I want to watch, I'm going to get HBO because I need to catch up with my Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay.
But while I'm having HBO, I want to watch the
yeah.
Mariska Hargitay. That's like part, that's why I'm like, man, you could. If you get HBO, you can watch Barry.
Yeah. Oh,
with
Barry's
Bill Hader
great.
Because I adore
Oh, my God,
him.
I love Bill Hader. I've been watching all his interviews on YouTube. But
I love
Barry
his
shows.
Laugh.
And his laugh, yes. Oh, my God, he just giggles
and
all the time.
I love his Dateline impressions. This is a
yeah.
true, this is honesty. I've never seen an episode of Dateline. Because of Bill Hader, I watched an episode of Dateline. Because I was like, what does Bill Hader love about this?
Yeah.
I was like, I need to know.
Have you seen his interviews where he talks about Snapped? And he just loves the show Snap.
He loves true crime.
He loves true crime.
Which,
and it's,
I'm like,
yeah,
okay.
Barry's great, by the way. It's really
well,
good.
I'm going to watch
Veep
it
is great.
While we have HBO.
Yeah.
And then it's like, maybe we'll keep HBO because we just moved in and we got the smart TV.
Yeah.
And I'm like, we didn't get cable.
Yeah.
And I'm like.
You can always do HBO Go. You've got a smart TV. You
well, yeah, to, and it's like
yeah.
$15.
Yeah.
I'm like, maybe. So we'll see.
I also watched Netflix had a new show called Bonding.
Was it good?
Yeah, it's fun. Each episode, they're really short. They're between, like, 15 and 25 minutes.
I do need to finish watching Fuller House, because the new season came out a while ago. I've just been so busy that there's been no time
yeah.
for TV.
No, I only watch TV because of the job I do, like,
mm-hmm.
sorting paperwork. And so, and then I stopped watching, like, new shows. I just was watching Doctor Who.
Well, yeah, and, like, so I've been watching Cheers and working on my practicum, because it's a lot of
yeah.
metadata.
Yeah.
And I can have Cheers on in the background
right.
and, like, work on it.
Yeah.
And so I've been doing that.
I feel that. Have you been reading anything besides school stuff?
I have.
I started a book.
I finished Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you read that.
I really liked
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's
I
fun.
Thought it was really good,
yeah.
and I thought it was the perfect combination of... See, the way you and Sarah described it, I wasn't entirely sold, but then I would describe it like... I wouldn't really say it was science fiction or, like, fantasy, like, the way you guys... I would say... It's the perfect combination of yesterday meets today and sort of problem solving.
Okay. You're like, such a metadata, like, librarian archivist to describe it that way.
I love it. I'm
well,
not
like,
not
I had
a
to
man.
Just, I mean, I didn't know. I mean, it's almost a little bit like magical realism.
Yes.
You know, but,
yes. Yeah.
It's along those lines.
It's like, yeah, it's like magic meets And I think that...
Because it twists some stuff. But
that's the thing is, I don't... Is it? And if you described it like that, I would have been... Because I wouldn't say it's... The way you guys slapped fantasy and science fiction on it.
Yeah.
And I don't like... I'm not a big fan of those. I like more realistic fiction. Yeah. And it was very realistic.
Yeah.
Except for a couple of things.
Right, right.
And if you described it to me like that, I would have been like, oh, well, I'll read that. And it was so good. It was very good. I think everyone should read it.
If you're a librarian, especially, or an archivist, or into, like, information tech, like, you need to read that book.
If you like Google.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Read the book.
But
beyond that, I'm reading currently A Discovery of Witches.
Oh, that's on my list. That's on my book shelf right now. I bought it specifically because I'm going to read it this summer.
Yeah.
With all my free time.
I mean, I come on, like, 240.
Okay. Yeah, that's my next, because, like, they started that Star show, and it looked really good, and I was like, but I want to read the book. So that's my... I'm going to start that next. I'm going to text you about it.
It's very good. I can't strongly recommend that enough again. And then I also started reading Desperate Characters, which is the book that, if you've seen the show You on Netflix, Beck buys it at the bookstore when she meets Joe.
Oh, okay.
So I started reading that because I was like, this book is going to be her downfall.
Yeah,
Let me read this book.
Oh, my God. I am reading a memoir of a comedian I like. Her name is Sarah Millican, and she's... British, and she's like really hilarious and a feminist, but she's got this really like sweet Geordie British accent, so every time she swears and stuff and says things, and every time she does it though, she sounds like so sweet and adorable, and she kind of looks sweet and adorable, so you don't expect those words to come out of her mouth, and she can be really nasty, and I enjoy it. But her book is called How to Be Champion. So there's this phrase in, you know, like, regional phrase, and, like, it's like, oh, how are you? Champion. Like, I'm good, I'm great, I'm doing well. But it doesn't have to mean that you're doing the best. It just means that, like, maybe you're just champion at being chill right now. Like, you're medium. You know, maybe some stuff has gone wrong. But you're still champion because you're still chugging along. So that's that's what her book is called, and I'm enjoying reading it. And at the end of every chapter, she gives, like, advice on how to be champion. And I started with my trainer told him about the book, and I was like, yeah, it's like being champion. So like whatever you're doing, you can be champion at. So like if I'm working on something really hard and the next person next to me is lifting twice as much or whatever, they're champion at that, and I'm going to be champion at this. We can all be champion.
That's right.
So I like reading comedians' memoirs because they're usually funny and interesting, and they all come to comedy. I love comedy and stand-up comedy, and I watch it constantly. Like, I just find YouTube videos, and...
I think that's my favorite part about Dax Shepard's podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Is just because he almost always has comedians on, and then they talk about how they got into comedy, and it's not funny. Their life stories are not funny. And so then you're like,
Oh, best new podcast I'm listening to is David Tennant does a podcast with. Have you heard it? Okay, well, the face you made. Okay, so he played Doctor Who, but he's also a phenomenal actor in all things.
He was in Harry Potter. Go on.
One movie of Harry Potter. He was really good in that.
You know what? Robert Pattinson was very briefly in Harry Potter. People haven't let that go.
No, I know. So he's great. He's a really good actor, and he's just very friendly, and he's got this podcast, and it's just him talking to people that are, like, actors, and... But I want to say 90% of everyone he's interviewed has been women. So he had... Olivia Colman, who was his first guest, because they worked together on a show, before she won the Oscar.
Yeah.
So it was like, he had her on his show before she won the Oscar, and then he had both Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
At the same time?
No, different times. Cool. Yeah, that would have been good. He's had, he had Michael Sheen, which was really great. Yeah, I just really enjoy it. I love his Scottish accent, and I could just listen to him talk all the time. And his wife helps him produce the podcast, and the actress who plays Jessica Jones, because he was in that. He was the evil bad guy in that. He had her on there. It's really good. I highly recommend that podcast. Christina something. Yeah. I can't remember her name.
Hey, so, I got her first name.
Good job.
Don't ask anything. I really want to read... I want to listen to... Because I'm processing at work, and like my first collection is a 109-box, storage-size box collection that I'm processing.
Oh, my God.
So I'm listening to something, but I have to be reading stuff, so I need something mindless. Which is a shame, because my favorite podcast is The Daily, the New York Times podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Love that thing. So I'm going to start to get into Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend.
Oh, I bet that one's good.
Because it's nice and short, and he gets a lot of comedians on there.
He's really smart, too. He loves history, and...
Well, and they hyped it up on Dax's podcast, yeah. on, like, Armchair Expert, and so I'm like, all right, you sold me, all right? Uh-huh,
yeah.
You sold me.
I'll give a shout-out to one of my all-time absolute favorite podcast is called The Once and Future Nerd, and it's a radio play, basically, and I think they're in book 2 or 3 or something, and it's just, it's basically all the nerd stuff. You wouldn't like it because you don't like fantasy, but all the nerd stuff combined with social justice warriors, combined with, like, a kid in King Arthur's court. So these kids from Pennsylvania end up getting transferred to this world where there's, like, magic and elves and orcs, but, like, they're, like, from our world, so they're like, well, why do you hate the orcs? And they're like, well, they're a different, like, people than us. They're like, that's racist. Like, there's a call out sexism and racism in this world all the time. And then, like, the elves are evil, and they're kind of like southern landowners, antebellum style. And it's so good. And the voice acting is really great. So I always tweet them, and they always respond to me. They're really, like, good on their social media. So shout out to the Once and Future Nerd. They're great. That's all I have to say. I'm, you know, looking forward to internships this summer and possibly some relaxation. I'm going to Disney next week. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, we get it. I don't know why I'm saying that. I'm going to Pittsburgh and Gettysburg.
Oh, fun. See, Saturday. I think that's fun.
It is fun.
Not quite as fun as Disney, but...
It's cheaper.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Actually, no, it's because of my love of Mr. Rogers, and so I'm going to go to the statue.
Oh, my God.
And
then
I'm going to go to the Children's Museum.
Take a picture, and we'll put it on our Instagram.
Deal.
Everyone can talk about Mr. Rogers.
I have to,
because
it's Mr. Rogers, and I just love him.
Yeah.
And I already told Mike that I was buying the movie while we're at the museum.
Sure, of course.
Like, gotta buy it. And then the money goes to the museum.
Send me all the pictures. We'll put it on social media. Everyone
Deal.
Can follow your journey to find Mr. Rogers.
To find Mr. Rogers, I'll be, like, creeping. Maybe I'll... I don't know. I don't know where he's buried, so I thought that would be nice to pay homage to him. You know, some people do that. Have
I
you
know.
Ever been to... In Margaret Mitchell's grave in Atlanta?
Yes.
People leave pennies.
Uh-huh.
Because that supposedly symbolizes that some what you did in your life was valuable. Mm. It had value. So people do that in Atlanta. But then in the same cemetery she's buried in, this golf legend, I think his name's Bobby Jones.
Okay.
People leave golf balls.
Oh.
And apparently before the Masters tournament, it's good luck to go there.
Yeah.
And there's a story that I heard that a famous golf player, I won't say who it is, jumped the fence when the cemetery was closed.
Oh.
To touch the headstone because it's considered good luck
yeah.
to pay homage before the Masters
yeah.
tournament. So
interesting. Well, yes. Yeah. If I ever go to Japan, Okinawa, I'll definitely go to the grave of the founder of my style. Because might as well pay homage. So yeah, we should do an episode where we just visit graves.
I would be down.
Okay, we'll keep that posted. Well, thanks for listening. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter.
And like
a Facebook
us on Facebook.
Page. Exactly. Send us questions. Anything
That's
you
right.
want to
Send
know.
Us questions.
All right. Bye.